We've got more advice about pets on Focus Today. I'm Jim Meadows, and veterinarian Dr. Sally Foote is back on the program to answer your questions about pets and pet care. Pet ownership is actually down these days, according to the American Veterinary Medical Association, and that might be due in part to the tight economy. So Dr. Foote will talk about the economics of pet ownership, how to control costs, and whether or not pet insurance is a good idea. One way to save money on a pet is to adopt it from an animal shelter instead of buying it. That's what Jane Dallas did. She's here to talk about the experience and what to expect. That's on Focus on WYLL. Our program continues after the news. There are fewer pets and pet owners in America. USA Today reports on findings from the American Veterinary Medical Association that pet ownership had shown a steady increase in America for about 20 years up to 2009. But in the 5 years ending in 2012, the percentage of households that owned at least one pet was actually down 2.4% or 2.8 million. The consultant who presented the findings at the recent AVMA convention says it's clearly the economy that's the reason for the decline. So do you worry that you may not be able to afford a pet, either afford a pet any longer or afford a pet if you wanted to become a pet owner for the first time? Forbes magazine estimates an annual cost anywhere from $1,000 to $6,000 a year for the ownership of one dog or cat. Of course, that varies a lot, especially with the size of the dog. But with that range of costs, there might be a lot of choices you could make that would affect the overall expense of pet ownership, hopefully without harming the overall quality of your care. Well, these are all questions to bring to Dr. Sally Foote today on Focus. She's a veterinarian in Douglas County, and she's ready to answer your pet care questions today, including those about the cost of owning and caring for a pet, from health care to where your pet comes from. And Sally, welcome back to Focus.
Well, thank you very much. It's great to be here again.
Also joining us on the program today is Jane Dallas, who can talk about a particular pet ownership experience, and that's the experience of getting a dog from a shelter rather than, say, buying it from a pet store or a breeder, or finding someone with a notice on a telephone pole saying they have free puppies. It's a particular experience. This is, I believe, Adopt a Dog Month.
Yes, it is. This is National Adopt-a-Dog Month this month, and so that's kind of a focus of our talk, I guess, a little bit.
So we'll be talking to Jane a little later in the program about that experience. Sally, I'm wondering, have you seen yourself issues in the last few years? You know, have you talked to people who could no longer afford to keep a pet?
Yes. I mean, There have been times where some people just flat out said, I cannot provide some of the basic care for my pet. And in my office, we really strive to be very communicative with our clients, very open. And that's not just for me, but from my staff as well. And I guess in a way, too, with the recession, really learned how to just bring up the issue of, say, cost and money, because some people are hesitant to talk about it. They may feel ashamed. They may feel, you know, self-conscious about it, et cetera. But when it comes to your pet, when it comes to any level of pet care, and that dollar figure of $1,000 to $6,000, actually the majority of that is, like, say, the food, the training, the grooming. You know, it's not only vet care. You know, the vet care is, on average, anywhere from around $200 to maybe $500, I've seen on some figures for pets. But anyway, still, money is money. And for some households, you know, if somebody's lost their job or they've had health care expenditures on their human side, you know, things like that, that have really now they don't have as much of that extra money, what's called the discretionary money. And that's what's spent on the pet. So what we strive to do is to try to help the owner find some solutions. There are some funds in some of our humane societies and other kind of sheltering groups that can be available to people who don't have any money. Or if it does come to needing to rehome a pet, you know, or if they have to give up the pet, either helping them and finding good ways to do that.
And it's interesting because I can see how people might feel embarrassed about it. There's something about pet ownership that seems universal. I mean, I've seen homeless people who have pets.
Oh, right. Yep, absolutely.
And maybe they aren't able to to provide the same sort of care in terms of money spent, but mm-hmm. but the bond between between the owner and the animal is still there.
Oh, absolutely. It's almost too that the more, what do you want to say, marginalized, the more a human may not really fit in with, say, the society norm or structure, their pet becomes even more important to them with that emotional bond and affirmation, et cetera. And so, you know, there are ways that I've seen homeless people and people with really, really low incomes still find a way to provide for their pet, or we can help with them on it. But it is important for them in trying to maintain that pet ownership.
Well, before we go any further, I want to put out our phone number and contact information. If you have any questions about pet care, give us a call at 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-WILL. Our email address is at will-talk@illinois.edu. And whether it's about the economics of pet care or just all the other problems and questions that come up, Sally Foote will be ready to take your question on. Again, that's 1-800-222-WILL. What sort of expectation should someone have if they're maybe getting a cat or a dog for the first time, as far as what they have to spend?
Well, it'll vary a little bit with the age of the pet. When you have a puppy or a kitten or a new bird a young horse, whatever, the first year of life tends to be one of the more expensive ones because they do have to go through a series typically of vaccinations, maybe wormings, and maybe even like a spay-neutering procedure. And so then this is all part of their, you know, preventative health care kind of establishing as they're going. Because in 1 year, a dog goes from basically birth to comparable to a human at age 18. So if you thought about, you know, all the kind of life care you needed, all compressed in 1 year, you know, from when you were 0 to 18, that would be a lot, right? So that's one age level where that can be a little bit more expensive, and one needs to plan for that. You know, dollar figures on that probably are going to range depending on dog or cat. But anyway, be expecting to spend at least a couple $100, maybe upwards of that, depending on the breed of your dog or cat. Then as they hit their kind of adult years, it's more of just maintenance. And that's really important to keep up with. Keep up with their preventative health care and proper diet and, you know, health exams. That might range anywhere from maybe $200 a year, depending on if you have a cat or dog, et cetera, upwards to maybe like $400 a year. And then as they get older, yes, their health care costs can increase or will increase. But again, there's ways to help mitigate that or keep that in better line, especially with early prevention and maintaining the wellness or health maintenance on your aging pet, not just to say, well, he's just old, and then they get really bad, and then you bring him in, and then we find out we got to do all these things.
You said 200, you know, the numbers I heard, $200 to $400, is that on veterinarian services alone?
Yes, that's really all I know because I'm just a vet. And of course, you know, if I had a Cocker Spaniel, I had to get groomed every 6 weeks because of that dog's hair coat. I have an expense in grooming, but I wouldn't have it if I had a Dalmatian. You see, because they don't need their hair cut, and I could bathe that dog easily at home. So that's where the variance
those
and
are
the
things
cost.
To consider.
Yeah, absolutely. I think a lot of times people may see the cute little, poodle. Let's just say I love poodles. But anyway, a little poodle or, like I said, a Cocker Spaniel puppy that costs like $700 to buy. And so they've spent the $700. Then they come to me and I say, okay, we got to do the first vaccinations and maybe warming. And then I need to see you again in a month as part of this booster series. And like, whoa, I didn't know all this. It's like, okay, well, and then you need to get the dog groomed regularly. And, you know, and then they're thinking, wow, I didn't expect this. But that's a part of where we really try to promote people to go to your veterinarian, or even if you're reluctant to go to the veterinarian, talk to the staff or even the humane societies. And on many websites, including ours, we have like before you get a pet, things to consider. And even on some of the websites, I think maybe AVMA on their website has even like a little calculator where you can put in, you know, the breed you want or the age, and it'll come up with these costs. So you can see that ahead of time. And that is important to really consider. A lot of people, you know, don't often think about that because they've never experienced that before, I guess.
One thing you're definitely going to spend money on is food for the pet.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering, we have Jane Dallas here, a pet owner, dogs and horses, I understand.
Yes, and cats.
And cats.
And cats. So you must know, you must be pretty familiar with the price of pet food by now.
My dogs are very expensive. They only like the best food from Dr. Foote's office. My horses are pretty cheap to feed, actually. I mean, hay is pretty cheap. Cats are pretty cheap to feed, but my dogs, they're on a special diet. So, you know, you do what you have to do.
And for people who are just starting out from zero, what sort of expense do you have a figure you can throw out there? That say if you have a dog or a cat, how much are you going to spend feeding it?
Well, it depends on the breed, too, because I have large breed dogs, so obviously they're going to eat more. I would say an average would be about $50 a month on a bag of dry food. But that's better quality food because there is really – I mean, you can go to any grocery store and buy any name – well, not name brand – any just generic dog food that's going to be a lot cheaper, but it's not going to be better for your dog. I mean, you see a difference in stool, you'll see a difference in hair coat, and just their overall being.
So,
absolutely,
Sally, it really makes a difference. And is the cost the real factor in the difference between mediocre dog food and really nutritious dog food?
Absolutely, yes.
You get what you pay for
in the pet industry. I know in the human food side that may not be so, but in the pet industry, absolutely yes. And, you know, especially when some pets may have, say, food allergy or digestion problems, it is really important to follow what your veterinarian recommends for the choice in diets. Some of the prescription diets, you know, the ones you get directly from the veterinarian, yes, they're the more highly priced ones because they are the best quality, and that's the smallest market for the manufacturers, you see, to make. So, of course, then, too, that's going to reflect a little bit in price. And if then it's like, well, I can't afford to get, say, the ZD by Hill's, you know, as a hypoallergenic diet, what's the next best thing? Your veterinarian may be able to help tell you specifically, say, at a pet store level, what's next best, but follow what your veterinarian recommends, because if you start just listening to what an advertising said or that, you may then have problems that will cost you more in the end than sticking with the diet that your veterinarian recommends.
Okay. We were talking a little bit about the cost of vet care. Were you saying it could be from $200 to $400 a year?
And that's in this region. Of course, if you live in Chicago or New York City, it's going to be more because the cost of living is more.
Does that include the cost of vaccines, which I understand may be mandatory? Certain vaccines may be actually mandatory depending where you live.
I'm thinking in terms of your general, you know, whatever core vaccinations are required, parasite tests like a stool test, heartworm prevention, depending on the weight of the dog and, you know, the scope of the coverage we need with that, and maybe another like just healthy pet check. Now, obviously, if your pet gets sick, it's going to cost more, but I'm saying kind of like maintaining your car.
Oh, just going in for a physical every year.
Go in for your annual, or maybe it's split up to two checkups a year, depending on the health of your pet. That would be the range in this region for wellness care, you know, health maintenance care on a pet, dog, and cat kind of averaged out.
Well, this is Focus, and I'm Jim Meadows, and we're answering your questions today about pets and pet care with veterinarian Dr. Sally Foote. Also with us today is Jane Dallas, and she'll be talking a little later about adopting pets from shelters, as she has done. If you have any questions about pets and pet care, call us toll-free at 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-WILL. Or email your question to will-talk. That's WILL-talk@illinois.edu. We have a caller on line one. Jen from Urbana, good morning. You're on Focus.
I'd like to get more detail about the cost of feeding a horse because I've kind of been out of that line for about 10 years now. And when I left it, $80 a ton for really good hay and, you know, $10 for a bag of some really good oats or something. But so I'd like to know, what are we looking at now if I wanted to find a horse or two and add them to my stable? What am I looking at for hay costs and feed?
Well, Jan, first of all, it kind of depends on, obviously, the size of your horse, but what you're doing with them, too. Mine are just kind of hanging around right now. I have an injured mare who's had some medical problems, so I feed a really good grass-quality hay, and I also mix with alfalfa. So I purchase always from the same grower every year. But hay costs are about... $1,200 a year, and they are predominantly on hay year-round. And as far as feed, I actually feed a concentrated feed, and they get 3/4 of a cup a day. That's it. They should mostly graze, so they're on hay all the time. So when I say that my food costs are really cheap, they are. They're less than $1,400 a year.
Do you buy square bales, or do you buy big round bales, or how do you present the hay?
I only buy square bales. I don't believe in round bales for horses. I know I'm going to get a lot of kickback for that, but I've never seen a round bale that has never gone moldy. Mm-hmm. I don't care how well you protect it. So I don't feed my horses anything that I would never feel comfortable recommending to someone. So square bales only.
Yeah, I use square bales too, but I was in I like grass hay. I always like to get as much Timothy hay as I can find. So. Okay. Well, that doesn't sound like it's gone way out of whack.
No.
Hearing things about $10 a bale or something a couple years ago, maybe that was just the drought or something.
Well, you'll always find those people who will hold their hay, growers that hold their hay, and they'll sell it in February and March when everyone's out. I actually buy from the same person every year. He's a farmer in Philo. He has excellent quality hay, and he keeps his cost really, really reasonable because he knows the people buy from him consistently, and so he doesn't have a barn full of hay. So find a good person with really good hay and just make that obligation to him every year.
Yeah. Well, and I used to go to the Saddler Elevator out in Ogden and get some oats and stuff. Do people still handle just oats?
Yeah, but you have to – I think the generation has really turned around from oats just because of the big, huge protein levels in there. And also just the digestibility. So I just really recommend finding a good quality pre-mixed food that is, you know, has all the vitamins and minerals that they need and not going overboard. When it says feed them 5 pounds, please don't feed them 5 pounds. Mm-hmm. They really need to have their bulk of their food in hay only. Yeah. And so that's why my horses literally get 3/4 of a cup, not a pound, 3/4 of a cup a day.
Uh-huh. Yeah, just to make them feel like they're loved, and then they go away happy.
That's right.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Jan, thank you very much. And, you know, I'm thinking compared to dog food, horse feed sounds relatively unprocessed.
Right.
Do the same rules of thumb that you get what you pay for apply?
You know, I would say in general, yes, because as Jane was pointing out, when it comes to hay, okay, hay is a grown product. It is going to have to be, you know, harvested, but you know, pretty much sold back out for consumption, okay, by the horse pretty quickly. It's not something that should be grown up in New Jersey and trucked into Illinois, you know, and then sold, et cetera, because it gets moldy and things like this. So, you know, finding someone who produces a good quality hay, and how would you know that? I would really, really recommend you discuss this with your equine veterinarian. Work together with your veterinarian who can make the best nutritional recommendation for your horse in your age with the lifestyle of your horse. If they're an athletic horse, if they're more of a, you know, companion, say, trail riding horse or a working horse or whatever, you know, and then from that, you know who they may also have some resources of who the local growers are, you know, with good product and et cetera. And so, yes, you're going to get what you pay for, because if someone's growing a good product, you may pay a little bit more on that per bale or per, you know, whatever ton cost on it. But in the end, if you're going to have a healthier horse for it, that's going to save you a lot of money. And then also, too, with the processed food, it's really important to make sure that your veterinarian knows what you're feeding and how much you're feeding, because we are seeing a problem with obese horses, that they're getting, you know, eating like kind of too much or too rich of food, and that they're not getting enough exercise. And so while maybe we can't up the exercise quite that much, perhaps we can adjust what we're feeding and how much we're feeding them.
I was reading something, and I'm sorry I don't have the source here directly in front of me, but it was suggesting that obesity in pets is sometimes a reflection of their owners, and just of American eating habits in general. That if there's a wave of obesity among the human population, the animals they own may tend to pick it up as well, because they get fed by humans who have those habits.
Yes, but I think the factors that come into obesity in the pets are not quite the same as our factors. So what I'm trying to say is that I've seen some obese pets with skinny owners.
Okay.
And I've seen some skinny, whatever, very fit pets with some owners that haven't adapted to that lifestyle. So
okay, so the pattern's not necessarily there.
Right. Yeah, the biggest thing is, to a lot of people, food is love. And the act of feeding their pet is an act of love. And because when the pet's like really, say you come home and they're all, ooh, really happy to see you, they may interpret that as, oh my goodness, he really wants his dinner. I need to feed him dinner. Uh-huh. And the dog, or more dogs than cats, because how cats eat is a little bit different than dogs. But anyway, let's just say a dog. The dog eats up his food and then he's all really wiggly and like acting all agitated and happy. Like, oh my goodness, you're still hungry. So I'll feed you more. Or maybe the whole act of, you know, because when you go by the treat jar, the dog's all real happy to see that. So you give them extra treats. And this is where the extra calories may come in. Then with our lifestyle, oftentimes we humans are not as active as we used to be. We don't take our dogs on walks as much as we really should. And even that one act, you know, of say, instead of the dog only going out in the backyard fenced in area or just for a short walk around the block, we now can understand that the act of taking our dog for a walk is a very bonding experience and a way to show your dog love. And that's part of what I counsel a lot of my clients on, is let's get them out for maybe a 15-minute walk, you know, twice a day. Then that can help to get the weight down. And but sometimes you start walking on some tender territory here when I talk about cutting down food with some clients, because they feel like I'm saying that my pet will think I don't love him. So it's a different dynamic going on a little times with
pets. But actually pets may be satisfied with just spending more time with you.
Exactly, yeah. Or doing other things, play, yeah. Even grooming your pet sometimes. Uh-huh. They like that because it's all attention.
Okay. You know? We were, Jane, we were talking about, you know, the cost of pet ownership, and part of that is acquiring the pet. And I'm assuming, like the horses, how much did you pay? What sort of range do people pay for a horse?
Oh, gosh, the horse industry, it's really changed. And it depends on what you're looking for. If you're looking for, you know, a barrel racer or someone that you're going to show all the time, you're going to pay a pretty penny. I mean, that's just true. But if, in my case, my paint horse was actually given to me, mm-hmm. from my sister, who got him, and he was kind of a wild man. And so she literally gave him to me. But she, I think she paid like $750 when he was just a little tiny baby. My mare, I paid $1,004 when she was just a yearling. So it just depends on the horse.
Mm-hmm. There's no horse. There's not a horse shelter the same way there are animal shelters.
Oh, yes,
well,
there
Share.
Are.
Yeah, yeah. Share. Oh. Share is a fantastic
Share
program.
Is the name of the organization?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and is that a national organization? Which
It's a local. It's Society for Hoofed Animal Rescue.
Uh-huh. Equine.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. It's a local organization, and I think they are part of the CARE group, which is kind of this overarching, almost like United Way group here locally, based out of Champaign-Urbana, where all the various rescues, humane societies, et cetera, for birds, dog, cat, you know, exotics, have all kind of made a network of each other. So if you can't find Share by going on Google, then maybe check what's called the CARE group on Champaign-Urbana, and they have a whole directory that you should be able to find them that way.
Well, our producer just put it up for me, and she says she'll be linking it to our website.
Oh, great.
At will.illinois.edu/focus, www.sharenet is how to contact that mm-hmm. organization. But speaking of shelters, you have a couple of dogs, and they came to you from a shelter.
I do. I actually had worked at the shelter for a couple of weekends helping.
And this is the shelter in Douglas County.
In Douglas County, correct, in Tuscola. We decided to help out on a few weekends with this litter of puppies that was just dumped in a box overnight. There were yeah. seven of them, and it was very, very cold. So we helped two weekends in a row, and then I decided I wanted to foster one puppy, and Dr. Foote recommended that I foster two puppies.
I've adopted one.
And so I took two. I did some puppy tests on the two puppies and picked the two best.
Yeah.
And took them home. Slept on the floor with them every night for 2 weeks, mainly because, first of all, I need to know where they were because there was two of them. But second of all, they needed to know that someone could care for them. They had no idea. So after, and my husband was gone. He was out of state. So after 2 weeks, when he came home, they were potty trained and they could sit and they could stay. And his comment was, why would you take them back? Don't let anyone have them. let's just adopt them. So once it was his idea, we just went with it. But I do want to say that early on, their names are Boone and Rebel. And early on, actually, there was a person who wanted Rebel. And she had come and checked him out a couple times at my house, and I really liked her. But her comment to me was that she lived in an apartment complex that didn't allow pets. So he was going to spend some time at her brother's until she could get a different apartment. So I immediately alerted, it was Kathy at the time, working at the shelter, and said, here's her name. Do not let her adopt Rebel, because this is how dogs end up in shelters again.
Yep.
Is if you're saying someone who's counting on having a stable place to keep a pet in the future, that's just not enough to be
then really you adopt sure. in the future.
Right.
You don't adopt now thinking this down the road. In 6 months, it'll be better.
Right.
Now, I should note, you started by essentially being a foster owner for a dog. And that's often when that happens, that is meant to be temporary.
Correct.
And I should say that there are several animal shelters that have these sort of programs where you provide a temporary home for a pet. And what's the reasoning behind doing that?
Well, the reasoning behind doing that is, one, for one thing, a lot of shelters are flat overcrowded. And so that's where some of them have to euthanize for space. So this helps to reduce the euthanasia. Number two, I think it's very stressful it's not a good, totally good environment for this dog or this cat or other animal to be living in a shelter for a prolonged period of time, like more than just even at the most a couple weeks. So to get them in a home setting is better for the welfare of the pet. Number two, sometimes we won't see if there are any, say, behavior problems like anxiety or even house training problems until you get them in a home setting. It won't show in that kind of regimented and very regulated and very scheduled environment like you have in a shelter. And so when you get them in the home, this can be like, oh, wow, wait a minute, we've got a dog who's, say, guarding over his food bowl we couldn't see in the shelter, or a dog who doesn't really like living together with other dogs, and it didn't, like, they fight over the bed, you know, and it didn't show up in the home setting. And so in a way, the foster home also helps to kind of screen for and then maybe be able to help rehab, you know, or address those problems before the dog or the cat goes out into an actual home.
But usually in the foster program, the dogs go back or go someplace else. They don't stay with the
Right, exactly. The goal is for this dog or this cat or this bird, you know, to go on into a permanent home and be adopted from this foster home into the permanent home. So the humane societies and organizations have, you know, the information on the network of pets that are in foster homes available for adoption besides who's in the facility for adoption.
Unless, of course, the foster pet provider falls in love with the pet.
We call that flunking. I flunked.
I thought it might be just a little part of the secret agenda of the animal shelter that a certain percentage of foster care pets will end up becoming that household's pet.
Probably. And I would still foster at this point in time if my life wasn't crazy with horses and three cats and two more dogs. But I just... I want to say a little bit about fostering if I can. I think it's an awesome program, but I'm not very big on weekend trials. I know some facilities offer weekend trials, and I think that just confuses the dog. Because people, as people, we bring a dog into our house, and we overwhelm them. We're like throwing toys. Well, maybe you like the Frisbee. Maybe you like the chew toy. Maybe you want a bone. And the dog's going, I don't even know where I'm at. So why are you overstimulating me? And then if we have a child, then we're letting, you know, Johnny jump on Fido there, and Fido doesn't have a clue. So people overwhelm them, which is why I don't like home trials. I like, if you want a dog, foster them, and it's just too much overstimulation. But what I think happens, and Dr. Foot can back me up on this, is if you take a dog for 3 days and you overstimulate them and then that dog acts out, then you automatically think you have a bad dog. Mm-hmm. And you really don't. It's really the person's fault. So, I mean, my recommendation is just make sure you're there. Give them time. Breathe. You know, play with them. But don't like, oh, let's try this and this and this. So I'm not a big fan of weekends. Mm-hmm. I'm a big fan of foster. Mm-hmm. Is that...
I think like anything, it's almost like a transition plan. I think having a transition plan, some of the shelters have developed this on the dogs going out for, say, these trial periods or foster periods. And that, to me, is what is really important, because you bring up some really good points. You know, sometimes people, the pet, the dog may be, you know, happy, like being in the home. And we want, it's almost like we want to abundance them with love and attention and affection and all this. And especially when you have the weekend, you have a lot of time. But for dogs especially, and especially cats too, they need an introductory period to this home. And that may take like 2 weeks or 3 weeks. And in that time, it's more gradually introducing things like, you know, like at really active play. You know, we won't get into it on day one or day two. We'll take them for a walk, you know, we'll do that. Or where are we going to feed you? We need to plan that out ahead of time, and also ask the shelter, like, what was his routine in the shelter? Because we want to maintain, like, part of that coming in that new home, like you said, because it helps to reduce some of that sort of confusion on the dog. And then also to make sure, especially if we have children in the home, that we have the children know the proper ways, along with the parents know, so the parents enforce this, how to pet the dog, how to approach the dog, that we don't go reaching around the dog's neck, we don't mess around with the dog around the food bowl, we don't hug the dog when he's sleeping. I just gave my expectant parent pet safety talk last night at Carl Hospital, so I've got my mind kind of running with these things, but that's absolutely true. Because when people return back the, say, dog after these trial periods, or cat, a lot of times an incident has happened in the home that could have been prevented if we had a better, just let's do this more gradually, you know, and that.
Okay. But since they are coming from the shelter, I think the really important thing to remember is that you don't know what they've seen or heard or felt. Mm-hmm. And so to just grab a hold of that dog like the little kids want to do, or even grown-ups. I mean, I hug my dogs all the time, but they know me. They've developed trust in me. Mm-hmm. And so people just, we tend to do that. Oh, what a cute little dog. And so you reach down and you want to pet it or hug it. But you don't know what that dog has been through. So you just need to give them some time and some space.
Right. I want to get into that in just a moment, mm-hmm. a little more about, you know, what to expect as far as the temperament of a shelter pet. But first, let's take a short break here on Focus. We'll be back in a moment to talk more about pets and pet care. This is Focus on WYLL. I'm Jim Meadows, and we're answering your questions about pets and pet care today with veterinarian Dr. Sally Foote of the Ocal Veterinary Clinic in Tuscola. Also with us today is pet owner Jane Dallas to talk about adopting pets from shelters, as she has done. For your questions about pets and pet care, call us toll-free at 1-800-222-9455, 1-800-222-WILL. You can email us at WILL-talk@illinois.edu. We're on Twitter and Facebook at Focus 580, and it is Adopt a Dog Month by proclamation of the American Humane Association. So we've been talking about not just buying a dog. You could do that from a breeder or from mm-hmm. a pet store, and it could run into for a dog, what sort of money are we talking about for a dog?
It depends on the breed. If the breed is popular, the price goes way up. If the breed is not so popular, the price is less. I have seen some people pay $2,000 for, say, an old English bulldog as a breed, and pay $300 for a pet beagle. And, you know, both dogs are dogs, and they're both companions, and they're good companions. And so one might say, well, why is there a price differential like that? I mean, when I'm talking about some of the old English bulldogs, I mean, what would be considered pet quality, not necessarily like show quality and such. And, you know, all I can really say is it is really related to more like the desire or popularity perhaps of the pet, or how many are like on the market. It's like anything else. If there's a lot of people with a lot of beagles, you know, then the price tends to be a bit lower. But, you know, if you are looking to get a purebred pet, the most important thing is to physically go and see where that puppy came from. Please do not meet somebody halfway between Missouri and Illinois to save gas or work. You need a breeder who is going to interview you, much almost like if you're adopting a child, that they are going to say, when want to see who's your veterinarian and call who's going to be your vet, and I want a referral on. You want the breeder asking you these questions. Then you've got a more reputable breeder. And a breeder says, I want you to come to my place and, you know, I want to meet you, and I want you to like see, they want you to see, be wanting to see, like me, if I'm going to buy this, you know, golden retriever, I should want to see the mother dog, the father dog, where the puppies have been raised, et cetera. How many litters are you having per year? Who is this breeder's veterinarian? How well are you taking care of them, et cetera? So
by contrast, adopting a dog from the shelter, first of all, you're probably not getting a full-bred, single-breed dog.
There are many purebred dogs at the shelters because, like we kind of started talking about, what do people expect when they get a pet? Some of them go in with this emotional kind of purchase and then 6 months later go, oh, my gosh, I didn't believe a golden retriever would get this big. Can't tell you how often they hear that one. Sorry. Or, my gosh, this Maltese coat always mats. I just can't handle all the grooming. And they surrender the dog to the shelter. And here we have a purebred, very nice, maybe very well socialized, very in general good health, had its vaccinations, etc. pet, and that dog is available for adoption. And this is how also, too, we have these purebred rescues. So the purebred rescues are like, a shelter in a sense, but they are, say, someone who really wants to be sure that, say, like this golden retriever or this Yorkie gets to a home who really understands, loves, and likes this particular breed, for the best interest of the breed. And so they're helping to really support good ownership and, welfare of the breed. So there are breed rescues. And in which case, that will be, a lot less expensive, quite frankly, in the long run. And in a way to get a purebred, dog. So.
Now, Jane, in the past, before adopting these two dogs, had you bought dogs before?
Yes. My golden retriever was actually from a local breeder. But once again, I kind of checked out that breeder before I even stepped foot on the farm to see. I talked to Dr. Foote. I talked to Champaign County Humane Society, a couple other people, to see if they'd ever had any complaints about him. Mm-hmm. What I was going to avoid was a puppy mill. Mm-hmm. Don't believe in them. We'll do anything possible to stop them. So when I went, both his parents were actually on site. I could take them out and handle them. You could see they were well taken care of. He had all of the shot records and even x-rays for hips on mm-hmm. a golden retriever mm-hmm. for the mother and the father. Gave me my certificate right away, and I knew that Jake had his first shots from a vet and had that, in writing. So that was very important.
Mm-hmm. Now, with these dogs from a shelter, and, of course, you had a different situation from other people who might adopt a dog because you fostered them first. You really got to know them by the time you made the decision to keep them. But is there going to be, because of the dog's different experience of being in a shelter, does that affect the dog's behavior?
Well, absolutely. It's just like taking a child in from somewhere that you don't know anything about and they're not old enough to talk to you. So the dog can't talk back. You don't know what their experience has been. So that's why I say you kind of give them room. You approach them quietly. You're not overwhelming them with different toys and loud noises and, come on, let's go for a run. And the dog's like, I don't even know who you are. So you have to just... I just always say be still. You just have to be still and kind of figure them out.
So they can figure you out.
Right. And the flip side of that is, Dr. Foote kind of talked about being food aggressive. I guess I've always been lucky. I've never had a dog that was food aggressive. I've seen it. It's not pretty. But people need to realize that if they do have a dog that shows food aggression tendencies, then they need to be talking to someone like Dr. Foote, who is a behaviorist. Because that it's something that you can get the dog past. But you don't get the dog past it by teasing it with food or grabbing right. at the food. There's right and wrong ways, and you need to talk to someone who knows how to do that.
One other thing I was going to just interject too a little bit, Jim, is that some of the larger humane societies do a what's called behavior screening on the dogs. It's like a standardized way of like testing the dog, say, for food aggression and testing the dog for, say, how they like children or not with, say, a stuffed doll and things like this. And that can help to see what the dog may have problems with, already. Always, you do something, like I said, you don't always see things until they come into the home. Dogs live by routines. They want to know that they're going to get fed at the same time each day. So we have to have good structure when we bring our dog. I'm going to get fed at a certain time of the day. I'm going to get walked at a certain time of the day. You come home and you go at a certain time of the day. These are the things that really help to kind of minimize or prevent problems, say, with separation anxiety and that. But some problems may pop up, in which case that's why it's good to stay in good contact with your humane society. And other resources. We have a lot on our clinic website for people, you know, with pets coming home from the shelter. I have one article called Rescue My Rescue, because sometimes these problems, when they start popping up in the home, depending, your Humane Society may not have a lot of resources, or there's some particular things, you know, with the shelter pets that can be, so that article can be helpful to people.
Well, we still have time for your questions about pets and pet care here on Focus. And have you adopted a shelter dog or cat? And would you like to give us your experience? Give us a call at 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-WILL. We're talking with veterinarian Dr. Sally Foote and Jane Dallas, who owns, among other things, a couple of shelter dogs. And, you know, of course, you went through the foster experience first. So, but for people who are just going down to the shelter and looking at the dog with the idea of adopting, what sort of suggestions or recommendations would you have for them as to what to look for and what sort of decisions do they have to make?
Well, obviously they need to do their research before they go to find out what kind of breed would fit in their house. I mean, if you live
If it's a mixed breed, there are still
Correct. I mean, obviously if you have a little tiny apartment and you have no way to walk or any grass around, you're not going to get this big, huge dog. Or at least you shouldn't, unless you're a big runner and this dog is young enough to accommodate that. And I always look at eyes. I'm a real eyes person, but dogs kind of talk to me with their eyes. Mm-hmm. And there's, you have to know what you're looking for before you get there, with no big expectations, because the dog that you think will talk to you is not the dog that will talk to you. You'll find that someone will just pop out at you. That'll be your dog to take.
And you're saying with the eyes is
dogs have expressive eyes.
Well, it's the way, how dogs make eye contact is a reflection of kind of their emotional state, all right? So in other words, if a dog is tense, just like people, their eyes will lower, they'll get a furrowed brow. And so if a dog is really tense and nervous in the shelter, that may be their temperament. Now, it also might be just because they're sitting in this run with three other barking dogs all around them, which is why it's good to be sure that that shelter has some kind of like visit room or adoption room to get into. You know, basically dogs that are really, like, that come to the front of the gate, not too over boisterous on greeting, though, of course, having a wagging tail is always appealing in that. The other thing I really think is important is, let's say if you're continuing on down the row and you walk away, that dog is not digging, barking, or kind of really going after the door of the run. This is where I see some dogs are doing that in the shelters, and they can develop a term called barrier frustration, which then can be a problem in the home if you need to use a crate or any kind of baby gate, you know, to limit where they are while you're gone at work.
Let's talk to someone else who has a shelter dog on line 4, Ray from Effingham. Good morning. You're on Focus.
Good morning. Well, my dog, actually, somebody had dumped her. Mm-hmm. We live out in the country, and my brother has a rescue where they just dumped it in mine, too. But he also went to a shelter in St. Louis to get another one. And I really like the way they are particular about who they adopt to. To me, mm-hmm. that's a good shelter, because
absolutely.
It's like, do you have a fenced yard? What's your income? Can you afford to take care of it? Lots and lots of questions.
Right.
Now, mine, she had been on her own for 2 or 3 months. She was skin and bones, and so she buried her biscuits for the first couple of months to save them. And, you know, so it took time to kind of get her, and she didn't feel comfortable rolling over on her back and rubbing her tummy. That took about 6 months. So, mm-hmm. you know, sometimes you have to work with those things, but they're all the dogs we have are great dogs. So, mm-hmm.
so it may take a little time to build that sort of trust that yep. would come easier with a dog which hadn't been through all these changes.
Yes, yes. And she's just a great companion now. At first she wouldn't get in the truck. Now she wants to go with me everywhere. So, mm-hmm. you know, it's just getting to know them and what their particular personalities are. So, but I do like the shelters. I would recommend that myself, just because I like to see pets being saved that need mm-hmm. a home versus puppy mills and so forth. But that's just my opinion. So,
okay. Ray, thank you very much for calling.
You're welcome. Thank you.
We do have another call in from, well, let's get to it. Line 1, Steve from Urbana. Good morning. You're on Focus.
Hello. I'm a devoted cat owner. In fact, I would go insane if I didn't live with cats. And anyway, my question is, I've read more than once in some of the sources seem rather authoritative, that there's quite often a major difference between dog owners who also may happen to like cats, but that just dog is their animal. Me, I'm a cat owner. That the dog owners tend to be controlling types, not pathologically, just they like the predictability that the dog expects that you people mentioned earlier, meals at the same time and all that. And then very seldom, I mean, have I ever seen a dog do anything just weird and funny that they never did before and might never do again? Whereas cats have this wonderful, you just have to deal with their unpredictability and weird little demands, and you have to be able to read their body language and their hints, so they try to lead you to the downstairs to where their food is and all that, but you have to be able to pick up on that stuff. Whereas a dog, he wolfs down that food. Mm-hmm. Cats might leave half the food,
right?
But that's just a part of owning a cat. That's got to be fresh,
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's all I was going to ask.
Okay, Steve. Well, thank you very much. And I'm wondering, or maybe it's just that you might seem more controlling if you have a dog, because dogs will pay more attention to what you want. Well, with the cat, there's less hope of them ever doing so.
And I'm going to disagree, because I live on a farm, and I have Dr. Foote used to make fun of me because my cats are really not barn cats. They actually come into the basement at night, but now they come into the house whenever they want to. But they get fed at 6 o'clock at night, and at 6 o'clock at night, whether they're outside or they're in my house, they will line up at that basement door. They know that it is food time, and they know what time they go out in the morning. So they have tendencies of dogs, but they're very structured for cats. And my dogs do strange things all the time.
Right. Well, I think kind of what I was sort of getting from the caller was, and this is what I see. I see the dog owner, truly dog owner. Dogs are what I love. Dogs are all I have. I have the dog and cat owner, like you. You have both, actually, dog, cat, and horse. But anyway, the combination of dog and cat owner. And then I have the cat people. Cats are it. Cats are what I love. So when I'm looking, personality-wise, I'm comparing my dog-only people and my cat-only people, I wouldn't say that the dog owners are more controlling type people. I would just say that they themselves really are the type of people who love routine themselves. They love routine themselves. They like predictability. They're the type of person who makes a coffee every morning and reads the paper every morning. And they love that, and they really love a lot of direct affection and direct, companionship. That's more of what the dog's about.
If you have those traits, you're a good match for a dog.
Right. Now, there's a lot of cats that can do all these same things. We kind of call our Siamese the most dog-like cat. But I'm just kind of saying in general, I think I am gleaning on what this caller was saying. So our cat people really, really love the companionship of their cats, and they really love that kind of the cat chooses to do what they want to do when they want to do it a little bit more, while you can also have structure and structure things for your cats, and your cats show affection in a little bit of a different way. And how that's a bit of the difference in dogs and cats. And I think that's the attraction for our cat people, is that, too, they can have a little bit more of a carefree lifestyle, if you will. You still have to be regular for your cat. You still have to take care of your cat. You still have to provide for your cat. But you can have a little bit more irregularity as an owner of a cat with your schedule and your structure. So that's where some people who don't like structure so much and don't like huge predictability in their lives seem to be much more attracted to cats as pets than, say, compared to dogs.
That's something to keep in mind, I guess, if you're thinking of acquiring a house pet.
Yes.
Just trying to figure, who would you like to hang out with? Someone who's very open and direct and craves routine, mm-hmm. or someone who might offer perhaps a little more variety and is ready to make their own decisions on what the heck they want to do.
Yeah. And sometimes it's hard for, if you're a cat person, and either you're thinking of getting a dog, or you marry somebody who is bringing a dog in the house, because then it's like, wow, this dog is just way different, and vice versa. You're a dog person, and then either you get a cat, or the spouse brings in a cat.
Okay. Well, that's something to keep in mind. And I think we're just about out of time right now. I'm sorry, because we have I think we have another caller coming in, but we do have to cut it off at this point.
Aww.
I want to say thank you to my guest, Sally Foote of the O'Call Veterinarian Clinic in Tuscola, and to Jane Dallas, owner of Cats, Dogs, and Horses.
The zoo.
Some of them from shelters. This is Adopt a Dog Month, and we invite you to contact your local animal shelter for information about adopting a dog or other animal, and also inquire if they have a foster pet program as well. We have links on our website at will.illinois.edu/focus to the Oka Veterinarian Clinic, and also to SHARE, which is the program for horses as far as adopting animals. Welcome any additional thoughts you have about today's program on our website at will.illinois.edu/focus. Today's show was produced by Lindsay Moon. Jason Croft is our technical director. Sari Lesk is our intern, helping with production and research. Monday in Focus, have you ever taken a personality test, whether it's in connection with your work or career counseling, maybe even a dating website? Well, we'll look at how these tests are used and how they're put together on Monday's program. Remember, Focus is live each weekday morning at 10 with a replay at 8 p.m. We're on the air at AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. This is Focus on WYLL.